Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor with Katie Galley, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio, and this will be a fun one.
Yeah, it will be.
All right, we're going to kick off the show with Bruce Ford. He is the president of the Southeast for Transwestern Commercial Services. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Tell us a little bit about Transwestern. How are you serving folks?
So we're a full-service commercial real estate company. We provide leasing, property management, occupier solutions for tenants, development, investment in the commercial real estate space.
Was that a media trainer tell you that? Like, that was very slick.
No, but fortunately, I get to answer that question or not.
Yeah, right.
If you don't know how to describe your company, that's a big problem.
So now, is commercial real estate in Atlanta different than other cities in the Southeast, or is the whole Southeast kind of a similar? For if a company was thinking of moving to the Southeast, is Atlanta, Nashville, is everybody kind of considered the same?
Sure, that's a great question. No, I think every city has its own unique components to it. So you have opportunities, depending on what type of company you are and what kind of business you're in and the employees that you're trying to attract, you're going to look at those cities very differently. So Atlanta, being a large metropolitan area, has certainly got a large employment base that it draws from many of the colleges and universities throughout the South. But Atlanta is certainly different than Nashville. And of course, more unique is Miami itself, which to some is sort of like going to a different place.
Right. So now in your role as the Southeast, a company, walk me through what happens. A company says, hey, we're thinking of opening or one office space in the Southeast.
Sure. So they would come to a company like ours that would provide them consultative services to help them discern where they should be in the metropolitan area, in the market, what type of employment they're looking for, what type of skill sets that they're looking for. Do they want to be close to MARTA? Do they not want to be close to MARTA? Do they want to have a headquarters building, or do they just want to be in a center city location, an urbanized location for their growth?
And then, so they're coming to you for office space specifically, not manufacturing space or not warehouse space?
So for us, we work in a bunch of different verticals. We do not work in the multifamily vertical, but we do help tenants or occupiers that are looking for either office, industrial, warehouse, manufacturing, and retail space.
Or some
space.
Combination, right?
Or some combination thereof. Absolutely. So our client base is very diverse.
And then how'd you get into this line of work?
That's funny. So I'm actually fourth generation in the commercial real estate space.
Wow.
It was sort of predestined, I guess. Although when I went off to college, I thought that was the last business I was going to get into. And of course, it ends up being the business I get into and have had a 35-year career.
So now what's attractive to you about it? What do you like?
Wow. That's a broad question. There are a number of things that I like. So in my role in particular, what I enjoy doing is getting the most out of an organization. So I enjoy mentoring to individuals that are coming into our space and into our workspace. I also enjoy helping people develop their own skill sets and providing great services to our clients. That's part of what I enjoy. The real estate business overall, though, is just a great diverse business. We touch everybody's life. Everybody needs real estate, whether you're going to a shopping center or you're picking up a delivered good from Amazon who needs a warehouse space that we help them identify or develop, or if you're going to work in an office building. So every day is different.
So now when a client comes to you, they could have a need, say, okay, we're looking at, we need a floor of space in some building.
Yep.
And then we prefer Atlanta, or we're moving from one place in Atlanta to some other place. Are you involved in also the development of a building where, like, hey, thinking of putting a building here? Do you partner with us to help us kind of fill the building?
Yeah, Transwestern is a fully diversified platform. So we have an investment company that goes out and invests in existing assets on behalf of ourselves or others. We have a development company, so we'll develop office, industrial, warehouse space for a client user or spec. And then we have our services company that operates those platforms.
So now your job is to fill buildings?
That is certainly one of our jobs. Another part, a big part of our job, is that we provide services to existing owners of real estate, and we provide property management and agency leasing, tenant construction, tenant improvement work for those clients.
So then they have the building, you come in and you're kind of running it if somebody wants a build out or something like that, exactly. or they want to take over a second floor, then that you help them in that. So you actually do the kind of the work in the building.
We do. Absolutely. So those are two different ends of our business, the occupier services side and the operating side of our business. The operating side of our business has grown significantly across the country. We're over a 350 million square foot platform here in the metropolitan Atlanta area. We're over 22 million square feet of space. So we provide services to a broad variety of institutional investors to high net worth investors.
Now, what's your take on the Atlanta market? Are we built out or is there still room?
No, there is still room. The employment growth of Atlanta over the last few years has been extraordinary. It's not something that a lot of people have really focused on because there's been such a strong economy overall and unemployment is hovering below 4%. But the metropolitan Atlanta area has added over 100,000 jobs over the last 18 months. Those are significant in terms of the growth of our market and our overall economy. We've seen a lot of it in build-to-suit activity like Mercedes-Benz just down the street here. And we've seen a little bit more of a throttle on speculative activity, which is good because it creates a more healthy and robust market.
So when you say a throttle, that means there's more of it?
Less of it.
Less of it.
Yes, throttled it back. So the lending community, as well as construction costs, have throttled back on the overall speculative development side of our business platform, which I think is good for the Atlanta market. If people remember coming out of the last cycle of real estate, we were overbuilt.
There were buildings that laid empty for
months or years.
Right.
And this time we're not going to see that. But at the same time, I would say we're not on the precipice of a drop off either. It seems like this economy has real legs to it. We certainly heard that yesterday from the Fed chairman. But we also see employment growth drivers continuing to bring people to Atlanta for their businesses.
So now the drivers here in Atlanta, are they the kind of Southeast headquarters of big companies? Are they companies fully relocating to Atlanta, or is it just the organic growth of the businesses here or just keep getting bigger?
Yeah. Isn't it great that actually it's all three? The wonderful thing about Atlanta is the synergies that are here today. So what we're seeing is organizations, again, I'll bring up Mercedes-Benz. Let's look at State Farm, also not far from where we're speaking, that have brought headquarters or Southeast regional headquarters here to Atlanta. Mercedes-Benz is their North American headquarters. So we're continuing to see organizations come out of primarily the Northeastern and Midwestern high tax markets to come to Atlanta to be a thriving business community. At the same time, we're seeing a lot of organic growth. Everything that's happening on the east side of Midtown and now spilling over to the west side of Midtown has been extraordinary. And all of that has to do with the educational community and the offering of that educational community here in metropolitan Atlanta.
Now, I think one of the unsung heroes of Atlanta are the diversity of our economy. Like we are leaders in healthcare, IT, and fintech. Now we have the film, now music, gaming. There's all kinds of, so if one sector kind of is hurting, there's other sectors that kind of pull their weight so that keeps the economy humming. Where in some markets, it's like kind of a one horse town where
it is.
The one thing hurts and then the whole town goes out.
Right. A great comparison is if you look at the Charlotte market, which is primarily a banking and financial services market, although they've certainly made efforts to diversify, versus in Atlanta, which does have all of these different aspects working for it. Go out to some of the great restaurants in Atlanta today and look at the crowd. It is extraordinary what has happened and unfolded over the last 15 years in Atlanta, that you can see a film actress sitting at one table and you can see the head of Mercedes-Benz sitting at another table and you can see somebody from the Falcons sitting at another table.
I want to go out to eat with you because I don't see those people where I am.
Anyway, it's been great for the community. We've certainly got a thriving arts community as well. And it's a community that gives, which is one of the great aspects of metropolitan Atlanta, is that all of these people have really coalesce together to make this a very charitable and giving community, which long term is great sustainability for the economy and for the overall marketplace.
Now, for your company, how do you serve the community? What are some things that you guys do specifically?
Yeah, so we're very engaged. It's a part of our culture. It's ingrained in how we live our day-to-day lives. So we look at ourselves as a business that is here to serve our client community as well as our community in general. So what we're involved in specifically, we are leaders with Make-A-Wish Georgia, and we actually have a national initiative with Make-A-Wish at the corporate level. I sit on the board of the Make-A-Wish Georgia chapter. We are very much supportive and helpful with the Feed the Homeless Project, which is a real estate driven project where we feed homeless every week downtown. We are involved with a group called Mary Hall Freedom House, which provides a transitionary support group for mothers with children, primarily up in northern part of Sandy Springs. And then in general, we get out into our community and help out and participate in a number of projects. So our team members enjoy that opportunity to be active, and we provide them paid time off for that.
Now, what about talent? How do you see the talent pool here in Atlanta?
Well, for us, I think we're very fortunate. Because we have been a great place to work for 7-8 years now, actually, we're one of the founding members of that. And because we've been identified nationally as a great place to work for millennials, great place to work for women, great place to work for diversity, we have been very successful at recruiting and retaining talent in the metropolitan market. And that's important to us. Our culture is absolutely at the foundation of every hire that we make. We can teach talent, but we can't necessarily teach culture.
Right.
And so we have been very fortunate. I think overall in the marketplace, it is going to continue to be a challenge. We are producing a great group of graduates that are coming out of the colleges and universities throughout the Southeast that will flock to places like Atlanta or Nashville, but Atlanta. And that will continue to serve the community well. But if we look at the demands for growth versus the employment base, we're going to need to continue to import a lot of talent into the market.
Now, do you see Atlanta? There was a time that there was a brain drain where a lot of smart people were here, they graduate, and then they're going off to other areas. Are we seeing the same thing happening, or is there a little bit of a reversal of that?
Well, in my experience and what we see much less of that. We see people wanting to be here. And I think it is because of the diversity that we spoke of earlier, the expansion of our economy into a lot of different aspects, arts, film, technology, fintech, et cetera. Atlanta is also one of the leading areas for cybersecurity. So there are a lot more opportunities here to engage those folks and look at the innovation centers. Georgia Pacific has launched an innovation center recently. Certainly what we see down in Midtown is quite extraordinary.
So now you're bullish in Atlanta and the Southeast as a whole?
Very much.
And then, so if you're looking at the Southeast, where are the hot areas? So Atlanta is being a hot area.
Yeah. So if we look at it purely from my perspective as a real estate professional, right, commercial real estate professional, right, we certainly see the hot markets being Nashville, Atlanta, Tampa, Orlando marketplace. Charlotte somewhat is continuing to be a good draw. And then you have the Research Triangle Park area, Raleigh-Durham, which is absolutely continues to draw great talent to that marketplace. It's a very livable area. So I think those markets, those five markets, are going to thrive over the next 10 plus years without question.
And then in each of those markets, how important is this kind of public-private cooperation and collaboration?
Well, it's extremely important. There's no question about it. If we go back historically to the early 1900s through the 50s, look at the extraordinary relationships that were formed between the real estate magnates and the towns and locations that they developed in. Some of the greatest projects were collaborative partnership relationships to make these cities what they are today. And I think we're in a period of time now where that level of cooperation is again on the increase, which is very important because it does impact so much of our community about transportation, education, accommodations, et cetera, that those public-private partnerships have to thrive for the benefit of the entire community.
Now, what's your take on the Gulch?
Well, I think the Gulch.
Well, first explain what that is and then tell us
sure.
why that's an important cog in the machine, I think.
Well, I think you're right. So if we, in looking at the development that's gone on around the Gulch and the fact that the Gulch is this great center.
It's a center, weird thing.
It's a weird thing because it's sort of subterranean.
Yep. Kind of connected back, how many years ago?
100 years ago.
Right.
Yeah, right.
And that's where Atlanta was a train town. That's why Atlanta is Atlanta, because that's where all the trains kind of intersected. And because of that, there's this thing, the Gulch, which is a weird, it's underground.
It
right?
is. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And it's kind of undeveloped.
It's entirely undeveloped. It just serves
by
as
where the
parking lots by Mercedes-Benz.
Right, by the stadium.
Stadium and by State Farm Arena, et cetera. So it has the opportunity to be transformational for the city of Atlanta. And I think that's why it's getting so much focus right now. While we all focus on Amazon, there are multiple groups that are looking for the city to engage proactively in a development of the Gulch to provide them the opportunity to come and relocate significant headquarters here. So I think from a business development standpoint for the entire metropolitan area, it's an important step forward that should be embraced. Now, of course, it should be done in a very transparent manner and an appropriate manner in terms of taxation and incentives and so forth. But there is no greater piece of land so centrally located that could be transformed into something magnificent for the city.
Right. And are there other cities that have this big kind of opportunity just sitting in the center of it? It's undeveloped like this?
No, they right? they this really don't. They would have to, most cities would have to demolish something
exactly.
in order to create something new.
Right.
This is a
it's just sitting
extraordinary
there.
Opportunity that, that, as you say, is just sitting there.
Right. There's an opportunity cost of not doing anything, too.
Well, there is. And like other things that end up happening in terms of how are we communicating either directly or indirectly out to the business community across the world. So the avoidance of taking those steps forward sends a message out to that community that maybe City of Atlanta is not ready.
Right.
Whereas if we continue to move forward in a proactive fashion, we send out the message, hey, we are in business for business, and we want to continue to support that.
Do you see some of the hesitancy? Is this chicken and the egg thing? They're like, well, if Amazon said yes, then of course we would do it, but we're not going to do it until, you know, we have a big commitment.
There is always negotiation at the table, without a doubt, whether we call it chicken or egg or who comes first, whatever that might be. But I do believe that most of what is going on now is the normal operative period of people wanting to explore and understand what this project means, what it means financially, and what that level of commitment has to be, while at the same time navigating the network with the Metro Atlanta Chamber, as well as the Georgia Power Economic Development Group, as well as the State Economic Development Group, of what are the opportunities to be put there so that people can put something real to it.
Right. But I think this is an opportunity, like you said, for us to be proactive. It's like we created the film industry with this kind of an incentive, basically.
Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely.
That changed the dynamic. It adds a whole other kind of a spoke for the economy here
right.
now.
Well, and I think that sort of snuck up on people, right? It's sort of nobody really knew what was going on. And then all of a sudden, every time you see film credits, it says something about being filmed in the state
right.
of Georgia or whatever. It's been quite exciting. So I think as we look at this from a business standpoint, as you point out, is that you want to put yourself in a position to win, right? These types of opportunities don't come along very often, as you pointed out. And those opportunities that we have here in metropolitan Atlanta, we absolutely should put ourselves in a position to take advantage of, whether Amazon comes or not, right? Who knows
right.
what's going to happen with Amazon? But there are other opportunities. It's not all Amazon-centric.
Right. It shouldn't be.
No.
Now, if somebody wanted to learn more and have more substantive conversation with you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Bruce.Ford@transwestern.com. Or call our office.
And Transwestern, you can just go, is it Transwestern?
Transwestern Commercial Services, yep.
And Transwestern.
But it's transwestern.com.
And then you can drill down to your city?
Absolutely.
Good stuff, Bruce. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Appreciate it. Thank
All
you.
All right. Hang with us. Got a couple more guests. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, I got Raj Chokshi. Did I say it kind of right?
That's exactly right.
Exactly right. And Raj is with Redwood Wealth Management. Welcome.
Thank you, and thanks for having me here today.
Did you learn anything from Bruce? He seems like he's pretty smart.
Bruce seems like a natural radio personality, so it's going to be a tough act to follow this morning.
I don't know. So tell us, Raj, how are you serving folks at Redwood?
So Redwood is a fee-only fiduciary wealth management firm. We're located up in Alpharetta. We are a holistic wealth management firm, and I think in the way we would define that is basically no stone unturned. So when we bring on clients, we're looking at every part of their financial life, not just one, which is what a lot of financial firms tend to do out there. So very.
What do you mean? What's the one that they look at?
Well, it depends on the other kinds of advisors out there. There's some advisors that focus just on insurance, some that focus just on investments. We basically give advice on all of that as part of our financial planning process.
Now, I read recently that in the financial planning industry, they, if I'm working with a financial advisor, say I'm working with you, there's a 70% chance my kid won't work with you or your firm. Like yeah. that for, and I don't understand. That doesn't make any sense to me. As like, if you're really serving me, you'd be serving my whole family to make sure we're all taken care of. Like, why would there be such a drop off?
No, that's a good, good question. And yes, that statistic is pretty true. What happens, at least a lot of firms, is they typically will engage the client. Then they're not really engaging the client's children. So at some point, you know, the client passes away or they get divorced, and these sorts of situations happen where the family splits apart and people go find different advisors. So in our firm, we actually engage our clients at multi-generational level. So one is all of our planning is done at a multi-generational level, but we try to get the kids involved in the financial planning process pretty early on. So for example, you know, when I have clients that have kids in their 20s, we may not tell the parents about their, we may not tell the kids about the financial situation based on what the parents want us to say, but we may sit with them and talk to them about, hey, this is how your parents' estate plan is set up. This is how your parents' overall planning is set up. So we kind of start engaging those kids at a younger age, and it's the right thing to do anyway. I think I look back at myself and think that when I was young and I was in my early 20s, if I had a financial advisor or even knew the things that I know now, I probably would be in a much better situation than I am currently. So I think it's the right thing to do to educate the younger generation.
Right. Even if you just said, hey, throw some money in a Wealthfront account.
Something,
like if
yes.
you just told them that, say, put $50 in a month at, you know, 15 or 20, that would make a huge difference later on.
Absolutely. You know, every dollar that goes in today is compounding for years and years
right.
and years.
And if you're starting
tool.
In late teens or right out of college, I mean, that's a huge window, the 20 to 30.
That's
to
absolutely
miss out
right.
on.
It's true. It's true. I mean, and so it's an important thing to start engaging our youth for sure.
So now when you're working with your clients, are they typically like rock stars and football players? Like who's your client?
No, you know, surprisingly, I think there are firms out there that like to work with athletes, for example. That is definitely not our niche. Our niche is usually small business owners. First generation wealth tends to occupy a lot of our firm. And I would say our average client age is between 38 and around 55 to 60. So usually it's folks similar to me, young families or families in general, business owners, people that have actually built their own companies or are physicians and higher net worth individuals. So that's usually our client mix.
So kind of the millionaire next door type people?
Absolutely. Those are our clients. Yes.
And then what are some characteristics of like what makes a person a millionaire next door?
Well, you know, this seems awfully basic, but at the end of the day, there are two factors that go into wealth accumulation. It is obviously what you make and then obviously what you spend. So it's really interesting where sometimes we will meet prospects. I had one recently that came in. They were in their 60s. And probably had income over $500,000 for, you know, maybe a couple of decades.
That's their annual income?
That was their annual income.
Right.
But they had $50,000 in total savings. So again, income doesn't always dictate wealth. And certainly wealth doesn't always dictate income either. I've got meet many people that have modest incomes that have very high levels of savings. So it all comes down to what you keep.
So now, how important is it to have somebody like you on the team to help that?
Well,
because like if you had a guy, if somebody came to you and say, okay, I make $500,000 a year. And they said, I'm going to work with you. I'll do whatever you say.
Yes. Well,
within reason.
within reason.
They're not going to have 50 grand at the end of this. I mean, it's unlikely, right? Just basic.
As long as they are willing to make some changes, it's sort of like, you know, if somebody who's very is not in great health or a heavy set goes to the doctor and has high blood pressure, the doctor will say, hey, you need to do these certain things.
Right.
But if you don't do those certain things, you'll still be heavy set and with high blood pressure. So right. at the end of the day, the onus is always back on the client.
Sure.
It's for us to provide them a roadmap. You know, the analogy I always give is, you know, if you're going on a road trip and you're driving from here to, I don't know, Washington, D.C., you got to figure out where you are. So figure out what your financial situation is. Where do you want to go? I want to go to DC. And what's the pathway to get there? And so it's our job to provide that pathway to the clients to say, hey, look, this is where you are. This is where you want to be. And this is what it's going to take to get there.
Now, when you're working with a person's investments can mean lots of things. I mean, you can say, okay, I want you to be in stocks or bonds or real estate or start your own business? Like, how do you work on what is a portfolio that makes sense for an individual client?
Well, for us, financial planning is the bedrock of everything that we do. So it's sort of like another analogy. I love analogies. You know, you go in a doctor's office and say, hey, I want to be healthy. That's fine, but you've got to figure out where you are first. So what we typically will do is we will do a financial plan to say, all right, well, John and Susie Smith, this is where you are. We'll do a lot of work around goal setting. So they'll say, well, we want to retire at 60 and we want this sort of a lifestyle. We want to achieve these things. So then we kind of back into it and then tell them that, look, this is what you need to do. You need to save this much money. You need to put this in your 401k. You need to put this in your kids' education plan, whatever it may be. So we'll help them identify what their goals are. Then we'll come up with a plan for them to be able to reach that.
But the plan, sometimes the plan requires a certain level of risk.
Yes, of course it does. You know, unfortunately, with risk comes return. That is always true. Now, so to answer your original question and tie back into your last question,
I just want to know how Bitcoin's going to fit in all this.
Well, you know what I always say is two things you want to avoid in this world is the plague and Bitcoin. So I don't think Bitcoin fits into that plan at all.
But Bitcoin as a symbol for more speculative activities.
That's right. Yes, when we're advising on the investment side, we're investing. Investing is very different than speculating. So although people like to go to Las Vegas and put their money on
and speculate.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, every time I go to Vegas, I look outside and I say, hey, this is not a not-for-profit organization. So certainly that is not our methodology at all.
Unless it's investing in casinos.
Unless it's investing in casinos. Absolutely.
So now, so then part of the relationship is developing some sort of a risk tolerance profile for each individual.
Right. Right. So again, you know, we will sit with a client and the risk tolerance is basically done two different ways. One is we do a financial plan. So let's say I've got a client that are in their mid 40s, they've got X dollars already saved. We will tell them, look, you know, this is what you need to save on an annual basis. And then this particular portfolio, this risk profile, whatever that may be for them, is going to help you achieve your goal. So it's very science and math based. So that's one way. And then there's an old fashioned way. The clients will simply say, hey, I don't want that risk. Or hey, I want more risk. Or I want less risk.
You put candy in front of them, leave the room.
See where they end up.
How much is left.
You know, what's surprising is I think there's a perception that folks that are older always want to take less risk. And even though they may not need it, which is what we will advise, we'll advise them the right allocation or risk level based on where they are. But, you know, a lot of older folks will say, well, I've seen every kind of market in the world. I know what's going to, you know, I know things go up and down. I'm okay with that. And then you've got this group of folks that are in their mid 20s to mid 30s that kind of grew up in this time where they've seen two huge market crashes. They've seen money, people get wiped out.
Right.
And they're actually more conservative in their take.
Well, if they went through any bankruptcy or home and they had to move or something, I'm sure
Absolutely.
That scar tissue is going to take a little while.
Right. The folks that are in their 30s started in the workforce right during the worst economic situation that we had in our country's history in the last 80, 90 years. And so those folks think differently about money than folks that may be in their 60s, you know?
So now when you're working with the people, is it ever a choice or do you ever present them with, hey, you know what? Maybe you should buy a franchise or maybe you should get into business as part of your retirement portfolio. Like, you know, maybe you were just laid off, but maybe, being an entrepreneur or a business owner should be part of that portfolio.
Sure. So, you know, we talk to our clients in detail about kind of where they are, where their strengths lie in terms of their careers and, you know, how they can actually make a living. At the end of the day, we're a financial planning firm. So one of our objectives is to help people reach whatever that ultimate goal is. So yeah, sometimes certainly it could be about starting a business, but, you know, I have to admit, I think most people that start a business need to really consider all of those risks. You know, I had a client that was laid off a few years ago. Mid 50s, you know, had a decent amount of money saved up. So the question is, well, you've worked your whole life to get here. Your runway for earning is now getting shorter as you're getting closer to retirement. Should you take all that money and risk it in just one business? Is that the most prudent allocation of risk? So we have to assess that on a client by client basis.
Right. But there is some level of control and then it gives their life meaning and they are doing something
the
next 10, 20 years where it would be difficult for them to maybe get a job and be hired.
That's exactly right. You know, especially as folks are getting older, it's becoming more difficult. I think it's a very personal decision. You know, I see businesses succeed. I see plenty of them fail as well. So you have to have the right temperament to be an entrepreneur. It's not for, I'm pretty convinced it's not for everybody.
Right. It's definitely not for everyone. I just didn't know if it was part of your conversations you have with your clients.
Sure. I think any of those things should be a part of every conversation.
Now, how often do you check in with your clients? Is this something I set it and forget it, and then I just check it, get something in the mail and say I'm doing good this month?
No, so we're a very high-touch firm. So what I mean by that is, you know, of course, we do the investment management. We have a bunch of CPAs on staff, which I'm also a CPA. So we generally will work with clients on many aspects of their financial life. So our objective is to meet our clients at least 3 to 4 times a year. Realistically, that doesn't always happen, and that's not based on us. It's based on our clients being busy. So our experience has been when we bring on a new client, we'll typically meet them quite a lot. Part of it is they have to learn about us. We have to learn about them. There's a trust kind of a factor. And then as time goes on, we let the client dictate that. We have clients that want to come in every 3 months. And I swear, I've got this one client that told me that, hey, call me when I'm either broke or I can retire. Otherwise, I don't need to hear from you. So, hey, it comes down to the client, you know?
Right. Whatever serves them. Now, earlier you mentioned fiduciary. Can you talk about what that is and why that's important?
Yes. You know, there's a lot of buzzwords in our industry, and I think fiduciary is definitely one of them. So I'll explain fiduciary and fee only as well. They kind of go hand in hand to some extent. So a fiduciary, it means that we are basically legally, morally, and ethically bound to do what's in our client's best interest first, right?
So of course, you.
Not over us. That's right.
Over the firm.
Absolutely. So you would think that that is how it should always work, but that is not the case. In financial services, I would say most advisors out there, I don't know what the percentages are. I'm sure it's north of 50 or 60% are not held to that standard. So our industry lends itself towards, you know, a lot of advisors that will sell products or do different things that benefit themselves, but not ultimately the client. So as a fiduciary advisor, we have to do what's in our client's best interest first. So fee only kind of comes in a part of that is kind of how do we get paid? Well, obviously, we've got to make a living as well. So we do not get paid from any outside sources. Strictly, our clients pay us our fees for the work that we do. So when I'm sitting across from a client, we've taken the conflicts of interest right off the table. They don't have to worry that Roger's going to try to push them to buy X investment versus Y investment because X pays more than Y back to the firm. We have no conflicts like that at all. And it's not just a firm standard for us. It's a legal standard for us, which most of the industry does not work that way.
So then when it's fee only, then it's a flat fee every year or it's a percentage based on the wealth that you manage?
We do it on a percentage basis. And we believe that's the right incentive. And the reason we believe that is as the assets grow in value, we make more money. So we're incented to help our clients do that. But on the flip side, you know, we won't take crazy risks to lose a lot of money either. So at the end of the day, our clients want two things. They want peace of mind. And you get peace of mind by knowing that you've got a steady path forward. And they also get peace of mind knowing that, you know, their advisor is working for them, not against them.
So now if somebody is looking for an advisor, are they typically, when they get to you, have they not had an advisor and then they get to you, or they're going from one advisor to another?
It's a little bit of both. So for one is, especially in our client base, we have what I call a lot of new wealth. So new wealth tends to be, you know, people that form companies and they have either sold them or
What's the number for wealth?
How much
money is wealth?
You know what? It's a different number. It really is a different number for everyone. I'm not giving you a political answer here. I can give you an example. I've got clients that they need $20 million to live. They need $20 million because they spend $500,000 a year. And then I've got clients that, you know, have a very, very modest lifestyle and they might only need a few a few hundred thousand dollars to retire. So wealth is all based on your spending. So, you know, clients will come in all the time and they'll tell me, hey, you know, how am I doing compared to this other person? I tell them, well, you really can't compare that. You're winning. You're right. Exactly. I guess that would be a good business answer to give. But at the end of the day, it is very personalized. So wealth is, it all depends, right?
So, but to work with you, do you have to have a net worth of $10 million or?
We are definitely high net worth. Generally for us, investable assets over $1 million is a requirement to work with our firm. And, you know, what's happened in our industry is these minimums are going up in lots of different places. for us, we set the asset level at $1 million because we're not just doing investment management. We're also helping people with their taxes, their estate planning, their retirement plan, pretty much anything to do with their financial life, we are a big part of.
So then for like if I have a board of directors for my family, you're my wealth management CPA, you're advising me of
I'm kind of like insurance. I'm your CFO. I'm your chief financial officer.
So you're doing my taxes or you're telling me who to go
to. So my background is I am a CPA. I've been doing tax returns for a long time.
Well, you'll do my taxes, Rob.
But you know, what I've learned about the CPA world, and I think most folks will say this about their accountants, and no offense to accountants because I'm one myself. But what ends up happening with most accounts is that they tend to be reactive and not proactive. So, right. You know, when you're talking to your accountant.
People love that.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, for a long time we did tax returns. And what I realized is that the actual preparation of the return is just a formality. There's no real value. I don't say there's no value in that, but the value is actually in the planning and talking about it during the year. So as a firm, we do a lot of tax planning during the year, and then folks can use whoever they want as their own CPA. To do the actual return.
To actually fill in the blanks.
To fill in the blanks, to fill out the forms. That's actually right.
You
exactly
don't
right.
do that part.
We don't do that part.
But you would refer, hey, or just buy TurboTax.
Yeah, sometimes it's TurboTax. Sometimes we have many accountants that we work with on a daily basis, and we kind of create a partnership. So, you know, our clients really are only still talking to us. They don't even talk to the accountant that's dealing with the return, but so they have everything in one spot.
Well, if somebody wanted to learn more and have more substantive conversation with you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Well, one is, of course, my name is Raj Choksi, Redwood Wealth Management. Our website's www.redwoodwm.com, and you can find information about us there.
Well, Raj, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Great, thank you.
All right, hang with us. One more guest. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we got Steven Eisenstein, and he is with Classic Tense. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, you made the big entrance. You know, we were doing our thing and you come in here like a rock star. Is that how it is in the Classic Tent world?
Oh, no. No, no. There was a couple of distractions. There was a fire on the freeway right here.
Yeah, the old car on fire.
I didn't have to make it up. It was literally, you could see it.
Sure you can. Well, Steve, tell us about Classic Tent.
Oh, certainly. So Classic Tents and Events has been around for 18 years now. I actually bought the business 9 years ago from a woman who was 65 and ready to retire and didn't really have an exit strategy. My background was all in catering, so I've been doing events for a long, long time. So I was looking to, I've got 3 young children, and I was looking to make a change where I didn't have to worry about food anymore. Everyone has an opinion about food. It's the hardest thing. Catering is very difficult. So running a tent business was something I was interested in because I could use my contacts and my creative ideas at the same time, still have a Monday through Friday job and not have to worry about weekends as much and nights.
So you don't do the catering anymore? You're just all in on tents?
Well, so now we added a new business 2 years ago, and it's called Coastal Equipment Rentals. So my dad and I both run that, and we now rent refrigerators and fryers and ovens and hot boxes and all sorts of wonderful food service equipment to people. And so we're involved with caterers now, but just in a different perspective.
So now you saw the business. This woman was running Classic Tents. And where was she? What were the opportunities she wasn't leveraging or not taking advantage of?
Well, she was in a space that was limited in size. So he had 12,000 square feet of space she was working out of. And this is right when the movie industry started getting hot in Atlanta. And we got into the film business, starting with The Walking Dead. So we provided tents for them. Another competitor wasn't taking care of their needs properly, and they got fed up. And once we got our foot in the door, it spread quickly, all word of mouth. So a lot of other location managers found out about our services, and our company has grown probably 3 times because of that.
So now are tents being used in ways that are not like kind of obvious?
So our main clientele are movie productions, our festivals. We do a lot of festivals every weekend. There's over 400 festivals that go on in the city alone a year. And we probably do 2/3 of those.
Every day there's a festival.
Well, I would say every
weekend.
On
the weekend.
Mostly weekends.
Festivals.
Exactly. So we do a lot of music festivals. We do a lot of events at venues like Stone Mountain, at Road Atlanta. There's a big race coming up, not this weekend, but the following weekend called Petit Le Mans. So we handle all the tenting out there for them. And it takes about 2 weeks for us to install most of that because it's a large install.
So now what makes a tent a good tent? And not just some guy going to Costco buying a tent.
So it's all about the vinyl. The vinyl is heavy gauge.
Right.
We use pole tents in our inventory and frame tents. And we have a large vinyl inventory in our collection. We have over 1 million square feet of vinyl. So we have a lot of frame in our tents.
And you can customize the tent to whatever size I need?
So the tents start as small as 6 feet, and that's for like a walkway tent. And then they can be as big as 60 feet in width that we own. Now, they can be larger. There's something called structure, which we don't own. We rent with other people for that item. However, they can be customized. If Business Radio wanted to have their logo and their name all over a tent, it could be printed on vinyl and set up. So that's something that's very neat.
Now, how do you kind of make them safe in terms of flying around with the weather and things like that?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked that. So one of the important things, we had a tent that actually moved through a storm on us. And we used water barrels to weight it down. And this is when I first got in the industry. And we had to find something that was better than that. So what we did is we went to a company that does tents as well, just like we do, out of New York. And they came up with a system called block and roll. And what this is it's cement blocks that have a little hole in them that we can move around with a special cart. And these weigh 350 pounds for the smaller tents, 500 pounds or 700 pounds. So we've got some great machinery that we use to move these around. We hire tractor trailers to move them from point A to point B. We can fit about 45,000 pounds of weights on a truck at a time. And we basically are in the hauling business. We're in the logistics business. We're moving stuff from point A to point B. And we've got some great people out there that know what they're doing to install these properly and safely. So occasionally we do have to use water barrels because all of our weights are actually used. So like next weekend's a perfect example, but we do it safely. We do it properly. And our guys are all trained and know what the right thing is.
So now when somebody says, okay, I'm going to do an outdoor event, are they tents are like the insurance policy sometimes if it rains or should you build in tents as just part of it? If you're going to be outside, then you should just build tents into the.
So if you're having an outdoor event and it's a special event, by all means, you should always have a plan B. So tenting for us is sometimes a plan A. So they want to go with the tenting to begin with, to have a venue, have a place to hang the lights, have a place for the caterer to work out of, or have a place for the guests to sit and stay out of that, you know, hot sun here in Georgia. But at the same time, we do have some customers that want to have a rain plan. So they'll book us. We'll have a 50% deposit that we'll put down. And if it doesn't rain and they don't need us, then we go on their business and they had like a rain plan, an insurance plan.
So it's insurance policy.
It does work that way. Yes.
Now, do you do that? Do you work weddings and things like that? Or you're,
so I'll be honest with you. Small? It's not our niche. Our niche is really festivals and movie productions.
Right.
There's other companies out there that provide glassware and silverware and china
and
fancy stuff, frou-frou things. We don't have any of that stuff. So we're basically a functional company that provides the basic surroundings. And we have tables and chairs in our inventory and linens and lighting and staging and dance floor. But again, our thing is not, we're not known for weddings and social events. We do some because some of our friends know us and what we're capable of doing, but it's not our main focus.
Now the restaurant equipment, that's just a side thing altogether. That's not really related to the tents at all, right?
Well, you know, a lot of the caterers that are in town have needs. And so we added this 2 years, almost three already, believe it or not. But basically we saw a need. There was another company that wanted to get out of the business and we had space. We had,
man, you're just like a
manpower. It was a beautiful
diamond
thing.
In the rough companies.
It's worked well together. So like
I bet he's got some wealth, Raj.
we'll talk later.
Right. We're very lucky. So like a perfect example of the two together now is Taste of Atlanta happening on the 20th, 21st weekend down at Old Fourth Ward. We're having to do both sides. So Classic Tents will be setting up all their tables and tents and chairs and things like this. And then Coastal will be bringing in all the refrigerators, the ovens and all their different needs that each restaurant has over that weekend.
So walk me through the process. I'm having an event. I don't know what I'm doing. I call you guys. I'm like, I think I need a tent. I'm not sure. So what are some of the questions you're asking?
So the first thing we'll find out is about the event. Why are we having the event? So we want to learn about that. And then basically we want to find out what you're going to plan on having underneath the tent. Because in order to figure out what size tent you need, you got to work backwards. You got to figure out what all is going to go under there and how much space that's going to take. And then from there, we would technically send a quote. And we do site visits as well. So we'll show up at someone's place or whatever location it is and measure it. Look for, you know, overhead power lines. We have to have underground utilities marked. We don't want to hit a gas line. We don't want to hit any kind of power.
You're putting
stakes into the ground when we
how
can.
How deep?
They go about 2 feet down in the ground.
So you have to know where the utilities are?
Very important. So 811 is our friend. It's a free service. We always recommend clients using that because the last thing in the world we want to do is ruin someone's event because, you know, the lines weren't marked properly.
So then so that's a responsibility of the client, or you do that?
You know, it depends. If it's a private home, then it's the client's responsibility. If it's a public space, then 811 will come out and mark it. Uh-huh.
So then you tell them that.
Absolutely.
Right.
We're up front and we tell them everything about everything they need to know.
So they mark the thing, then what's next?
So basically they either agree to our pricing or they don't. And we show up, we set up the event. We technically leave before the event happens, and then their event goes on. We see lots of great pictures on Facebook or Instagram or wherever it may happen. And then later after the party's over, we come back and take it down.
And then typically how long are you, the minute it ends, someone's there taking down the tent, or when do you guys
come back?
It
all depends on what's going on. If there's overnight security and it's a safe location, then the stuff will stay there and we'll come back the next day when there's sunlight to take it down.
Now, is there ever an issue with like somebody trying to steal a tent? Has that ever happened?
Oh, of course.
Of course?
Unfortunately, this world is full of crazy things. So, we had a Decatur Book Festival one year that somebody decided to take a knife out and start slashing some of the walls. We've had tents, sometimes you show up and someone's stolen a tent. It happens.
Like it's not there.
Gone. People could steal it and take it to get it recycled because of the frame is worth money.
Oh.
So it depends on the location. So there are certain places that we, won't set up a tent because we know it's not safe.
So now how do you deal with that? Is there some
good old insurance? Oh, absolutely.
So you have it or you make the client have it?
So we both. Mm-hmm. Yep. It depends on, the amount the tent's worth. But technically, the client's responsible while it's on their location.
Right. So now, and then how often does that happen? 1 out of 10? 1 out of 100?
So I've seen all sorts of things in 9 years happen. So it hasn't happened that often, thank goodness.
Right. So but it's a rarity.
It is a rarity. Crazy things happen. So we've also had storms that have gone through. A little microburst has taken down a tent on someone's land. And we've had some, things injured, unfortunately. So again, that's where the insurance comes into play. And that's why we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on insurance. It's not cheap.
So now out of the 400 events that are happening or festivals, how many are classic tents getting involved with?
About two thirds.
You have two thirds of the event business?
So the whole, when I started getting into this business, the Rhea, the woman I bought the business from, had her real roots in events, and festivals was really big for us. So we've continued on with festivals and just added other market segments since then. So we've added a lot of employees. We're up to 40 employees now. So when I first started, we were at 4. So we've grown this thing a lot, and we're in a much bigger space. We moved into a building we bought about 5 years ago. It's 44,000 square feet, and it's got 4 acres of land it's on. So we built a washing machine on this property, and we can
clean the vinyl
to wash this tent. Yep. And so yesterday we actually had an improvement. We had an upgrade. We have a new machine that's 5,000 square feet that we can wash at a time. So right now there's a plumber at our office working on it. We had power installed yesterday.
Wow.
So we've doubled the capacity that we can wash at a time. And then we've got these large drying racks outside. One of them 60 feet across and they're 35 feet tall.
Like a big clothesline.
Huge. And it's got a big crank so the guys can take it up and let it dry by the sun, and it'll stay up for about 4 to 6 hours, and then we'll fold it and put it back once it's dry and keep them clean.
So now when you had a small company, it had certain logistical challenges. As it grew, the logistical challenges expanded, obviously. How did you kind of learn how to do all this? Like, was it just
I hired really great people. So 2 years ago, I added a general manager, and our Carlos Mino has been phenomenal to help us grow, helping find more labor, helping put more systems into place, helping add more equipment. So it's really a team effort. We can't do this by ourselves. So it's a big group. We've got lots of great professionals out in the field that install. The drivers are technically responsible for the crew, so they call ahead of time to let the customer know we're on the way. And again, without great salespeople, we couldn't do what we do. So we've got some great salespeople back at the office that do a great job. They have 100% customer satisfaction, and we retain our clients for a long time.
So now, is your business primarily in the Atlanta or Georgia, or is it all over? It can be anywhere.
So primarily, we stay here in Georgia. There is one event a year that we take care of that's on a national basis. We put up tents and they are selling Christmas trees underneath these tents at about 12 different states that we manage the logistics for. And we also get all the permits for these as well. So sometimes getting the permits is harder than actually installing the tents.
Oh, you have to go to the government to get the...
Absolutely. And they charge for it, of course.
So now you're in the Christmas tree business. That's a third business?
So no. So we basically have a vendor that we work for and we handle all of their...
Look, you do the tent part and I'll...
Correct. And they'll fund it.
Right. So how'd you get into that?
So again, like they were a customer already when we first
So you were doing it here locally, and then they're like, hey, now we're in 12 states. Can you come with me?
We were driving to Florida, driving to South Florida, and did about 20 tents for them. And the program expanded, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And they figured out that selling a lot of Christmas accessories at that time of year is wonderful.
So now, but that's kind of a one-off.
It is, right. But there's one person that's focused on that year-round.
And that's their job year-round.
Correct.
So do you have any aspirations to go to other markets with this? And then kind of, I don't know, franchise or just have other satellite offices?
So, there's enough work in this town to keep me happy. Running two different businesses and having a family is like juggling, and I'm a good juggler.
I know, because literally. Got that good general manager.
Thank goodness.
So get another one.
Exactly.
Nashville.
I quite frankly, there's other companies out there that are doing it that have already expanded, and there's enough market share here in Georgia that we are content with what we've got going on. Uh-huh. There might be other companies out there that are other services that we could provide so we can continue, like air conditioning, power, restrooms, right. Audiovisual. There's a lot of other items that could be worked into us.
So then when they come to you, they're asking specifically for a tent, though. They're not going, hey, do you know a good AV guy?
So or do sometimes we're very good at referrals. We get asked all kinds of questions. So we have a great network of fellow vendors that we do work with and that we refer business back and forth. And so there's a good partnership there.
So they do ask you like, absolutely. Hey, you know anything else?
They'll ask us for everything. And it works well because we share our friends and the friends take good care of them, and it works well. So one of the items that we have in our inventory are makeup mirrors. So all the movie productions,
makeup mirrors
are used
part of
by
your
every
tent
team. So we had a partnership with another company that basically his wife was a makeup artist and he invented this box, and it's basically a makeup mirror box that we transport. It's got great wheels on it and they go all over the city. So every film or TV show that's in town that's up and running, we'll use them.
And then so
we'll rent
you're the exclusive vendor for makeup mirrors.
Well, there's another company in town that has some as well, but we have a very good reputation of taking great care of our clients.
And then because movie people, they got all kinds of weird needs, right?
You said it.
And then they can ask for anything.
And at all hours of the day. So we get calls.
Hurry up and
wait. At 11 o'clock at night for a job the next morning. So a lot of times, you know, things change on them.
Right.
And so we're able to respond and take care of it and work at odd hours, 7 days a week.
Well, Steve, if somebody wanted to learn more about Classic Tents or has a need for a tent, how do they find you?
Yeah.
Where do they go?
Give us a ring at 770-449-1010. You can find us on Facebook.
1010. That's almost 10.
Isn't it?
Is that an accident? Is that an accident?
It was all luck.
Serendipity?
Exactly.
Was it?
It was.
Really?
Totally.
Wow. But and then the website?
It's classic-tents.com.
And then the restaurant equipment?
Is coastalrental.com.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Katie Galley and all our guests here today. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.